Good morning, everybody. Is this on now? Okay. In the first couple of weeks after Mark invited me to give a message on one of the second Sundays, I kept going back and forth between two possible topics. My first thought was to reflect on my spiritual practice that has been helping me cope with the world since November 9th. In my efforts to move from a state of anxiety to one of more calmness, from total despair to one of more joy, from fear to more courage, from self-righteousness towards more humility. And I started writing it, perhaps trying to follow the traditional pastoral charge, even though, of course, I'm not a pastor, to comfort the afflicted. And certainly most of us have felt some affliction in recent months. But in contemplating this historical moment, as the pastoral nominating committee is beginning its work, another message kept percolating in my consciousness, one that may be more in line with a different pastoral charge, to afflict the comfortable. Most of us, including me, can be counted as among the comfortable. In fact, the most privileged in relation to the vast majority of people on this earth. I don't wish to trivialize the challenges that we all face in living a human life, and some of you are facing ones now that dwarf mine by comparison. Although I'm not trying to disturb anyone, sharing some of my own struggles and questions in being part of this church may have that effect, and that increases my discomfort. I almost chickened out and went back to the soothing message I started. But since I'm trying to have more courage than fear, here goes. When I started attending this church many years ago, I didn't consider myself a Christian for the same reason that many of you did not and do not. I thought Jesus seemed like a really good man, but I couldn't believe in the supernatural stuff. Jim Dollar's messages back when I started reinterpreting biblical stories helped me see possibilities in Christianity that I had not thought were there. I loved that he both affirmed my doubts and added new questions. But there was always something missing for me. The focus of the church seemed to be largely about us, what made us feel better. A statement from Howard Thurman frequently graced the Sunday bulletin. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. I knew that I most came alive in relation with other people, especially when I could be helpful to those in need, an interpretation that allowed me to make peace with Thurman's statement. At the same time, I questioned myself, knowing that helping others has often been used as a way for some people to reinforce their sense of superiority over those needing the help. But in my struggles, I also wondered about when the descriptor of covenant as the church that serves had gone away, and about when we began serving mainly ourselves. Related questions also arose for me in thinking about progressive Christianity. And we also describe ourselves as a progressive Christian church. I have read lots of books by multiple progressive authors and attended most of the talks by progressive theologians that this church hosted. As an intellectually minded person who had a religion minor in college and who spent most of my career as an academic, all this was appealing to me. But unlike many of you who still find it spiritually nourishing, eventually, my intense interest in such theological discussion flagged. Partly, it was because I started finding it repetitious. But I also struggled with my sense that it felt somewhat self-righteous by implying that we were right and all those non-progressives were wrong. It seemed useful in reinforcing what I already believed, and in providing ammunition for reacting to those who were still using old theological interpretations to justify positions and actions I found problematic. But it didn't seem very useful in helping me really listen to people who thought differently. Since the election, I've become even more interested in understanding those folks. My efforts over the last 6 months have helped me recognize that all people who see the world differently are not stupid bigots. And I have learned how some of them seem to be following Jesus' call to care for the oppressed in ways that have made me more intensely aware of what I have been missing here at this church. When I look at the current principles for progressive Christianity, I note that they say more about what progressive Christians believe than about what they do. I asked Kate to copy two versions of these principles and hope everybody has one. If not, I know there are more in the back. As you will notice, and the old statement is at the top and the newer statement is at the bottom, but both versions begin with the statement, by calling ourselves progressive, we mean that we are Christians who, dot, dot, dot. And when I compare the current list of principles to the ones I first read, dated 2003, I note that today's version seems to make it easier to be a progressive Christian. The strongest language calling us to make a difference in the world has been considerably softened since 2003. In particular, I see a watering down of number 7, which then stated that we are Christians who form ourselves into communities dedicated to equipping one another for the work we feel called to do, striving for peace and justice among all people, protecting and restoring the integrity of God's creation, and bringing hope to those Jesus called the least of his sisters and brothers. Number 8 from 2003 has been eliminated. It stated that we recognize that being followers of Jesus is costly and entails selfless love, conscientious resistance to evil, and renunciation of privilege. Whoa. Bringing hope to those without it, conscientious resistance to evil, renouncing privilege. Those definitely sound like Jesus, who was not just a good man, but a really radical and courageous one. While I've had some pretty radical thoughts about social justice and done some writing about social justice and some activism, I'm still relatively low in the courage department. And when I look at this evolution of principles, I realize I'm not the only one. Of course, I can come up with all sorts of reasons why I am not renouncing my privilege and bringing all that much hope to those Jesus called the least of his sisters and brothers. For example, I live in a house much larger than 2 people need at a time so many folks in our community are homeless and so-called vagrants are sleeping just outside this church. But I live in my house with someone I love and made a commitment to 48 years ago, someone who doesn't feel the calling that I do. So I have a very convenient excuse for not selling all I have and giving to the poor, protecting me from taking action, which could be terrifying because it could leave me financially destitute, certainly unable to pass on anything of monetary value to our children. I also haven't suggested sharing our home with a homeless family. I have a hard enough time living with one other adult with all the minor irritation that involves. But clearly, I'm too focused on my own security and comfort to be a real follower of Jesus. All of us have very good reasons about why we are not doing more to try to help right the wrongs of the world. And there are a lot of easier ways to come alive than to follow the most challenging calls from Jesus, and a lot of ways to serve the community that don't require great sacrifice. During the time I was serving as co-chair of the Outreach Committee, although there was never a committee, Sarah Sills and I tried to find a major project that could pull us together as a church community while making a difference in the larger community. We initially tried a number of very small projects requiring only an hour or two, but nothing caught on, and we faced some painful criticisms in the process. So we did a survey to try to find out what kinds of causes people cared about and discovered that a number of people at Covenant were involved in important causes outside the church, but were interested in a church commitment only if it were to the cause that had already claimed them. I then realized that this church had been out of practice as a church that serves the community for a number of years, and those among us who wanted to be involved in striving for peace and justice, protecting and restoring the integrity of creation, and bringing hope to those Jesus called the least of his sisters and brothers, had found our own path outside of the church. Eventually, Sarah and I gave up trying to make it happen within the church and expanded our own individual efforts outside it. None of this is an indictment of people here, even those who are not involved in any community service. Many feel full up just taking care of themselves and their immediate families, and others are committed volunteers within Covenant. The only regular church community service activity I know of is monthly brunch at Higher Ground, which Sarah and I, along with Jim North, Ralph Coven, Laura Farlow, and Jane Walters, still carry on. I know we all feel like we are getting far more than we give in that couple of hours once a month. I won't leave you, though, with my own tale of struggle, disappointment, and failure, but with an inspiring one after all. Krista Tippett, in her recently published book, Becoming Wise, shared several stories that are relevant not just to my concerns, but to our hope of attracting to this church people who might share our progressive theology. She writes, "The growing universe of the nuns, the new non-religious, is one of the most spiritually vibrant and provocative spaces in modern life. It is not a world in which spiritual life is absent. Large swaths of this universe are wild with ethical passion and theological curiosity." Millennial journalist Nathan Schneider wrote an unorthodox and captivating insider's account of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which arose in the wake of the economic crisis of 2008. He also spoke about a spiritual dynamic missed by other commentators in the secular political movement that was Occupy Wall Street. And these are Schneider's words. "When young people started turning their attention to churches, sometimes actually protesting in front of churches, it wasn't that they were protesting the theological points that a church would claim to believe. What they were actually saying was, 'Church, act like a church.' Many of these were people who had never really been part of a church or in or another kind of religious community. Or if they had, they'd had some experience of alienation. The general identity was that of the nuns." Now, while Schneider was raised by parents who exposed him to every spiritual tradition and invited him to create his own, he chose to be baptized as a Roman Catholic at the age of 18. He says he was drawn by both the medieval contemplative tradition as well as the tradition of courageous social witness, such as Dorothy Day's work and, of course, liberation theology. On the other hand, Schneider says that people he has found outside of churches had, quote, "very good questions they were trying to think through and work through. They didn't feel like they could commit themselves to these institutions, but they were curious and they were looking for something. It was so striking to me, that cry of Occupy, act like a church." And he continues to share about when Hurricane Sandy hit New York City and surrounding regions, and immediately a small group of people who had been involved in Occupy Wall Street decided they were going to organize some kind of relief effort. They had to do something, and they did. They had the first website up, the first place on the ground where people could deliver supplies to churches. And they ended up becoming a major part of the early phases of the relief effort. But, he continues, it was really interesting to see, in the course of that process, this group of people, many of whom did not have comfortable relationships with traditional religious institutions, work with these religious folks. And they would see what they could draw from the ideas of these traditions. They started talking about Jubilee. They started recognizing that there was something real in this religious language that connected with the frustration they were feeling with the society around them. I don't have time this morning to share more of Nathan Schneider's story or stories about what many other Greensboro churches are doing that lift me up and make me envious when I go into them for various social justice activities, such as St. Barnabas Episcopal Church now providing sanctuary to an undocumented immigrant woman, Juana Tobar Ortega. And there's a story on the front page of today's News and Record. Or Westminster Presbyterian's latest initiative to feed the hungry called A Simple Gesture. Neither of these churches, or the many others responding to needs in this community, describe themselves as progressive Christian congregations. But as the words, church, act like a church, continue to haunt me, I leave you and the Pastoral Nominating Committee with this question. What kind of a church will we